Welcome to the Voices of Boyle podcast, Barry. Thanks very much for inviting me into your home to record this episode. Before we start talking about a few different topics, like your involvement in the Boyle Arts Festival, your volunteer work, and your involvement in the GAA, can you first tell me a bit about where you were born and where you grew up?
Well, I was born on the 27th of June 1940 to my parents, Henry and Una Feely. Una was a country girl, Hanmore, from Knockavraw. And when they got married, she was in her early 20s. And Dad was about maybe 10 years older. And I often thought it was unusual that he was took part in the War of Independence. And her father was an RIC man. I asked her one time how did it go down when she told him she was getting married to Henry Feely. But she was too old at the time, I think, to answer the question, you know. But I had a very happy childhood. I went to school in St. Joseph's over in Mockmoyne. We had Master Tarpey, Master Kennedy and Master Mannion. They were the three classes. Now, I had a very checkered period in school because I was dyslexic. And in those days, dyslexic wasn't known. It was just plain stupid. So when I left school, I hadn't too much ambition. Because being dyslexic, you were always behind and wondering how you'd find your way. But eventually I found my way when I got out of school and I went and served my time with my father as a stonecutter and carver. He was a good carver, Celtic interlacing, and he was a very good letter cutter. So I picked up all those skills. And I started with him in 1955. So work was still being done by hand. And we in Boyle were held back a little bit because we had DC current produced by Stewart's Mill. So we could only use a one horsepower machine. So we just had one small machine for sanding. So we couldn't put in any bigger machines because the power wasn't there. But in going to school, I had I went to school down in Aachena, Ballindoon, and my aunt was teaching there, and they were in danger of losing of the school closing because the numbers were down. So I was carted off for a year down there. And it happened again then when I was in sixth class and my brother Michael and I were sent to Currigan Row School because again they were had a two-teacher school and it was in danger of going down to one because of the numbers. So we cycled out there 5 miles every morning and evening. And of course, being the townies, the only townies, we had to learn how to defend ourselves because there was plenty of guys there to test us out. But we got over that anyhow, and I have no bad memories of it. My uncle was teaching me. Only one of the problems was that he was a diehard De Valera man.
Right.
And all my family were Michael Collinses. So I got plenty of reminders how great a man De Valera was when I was there. But that was all part of it. Yeah. And then there was some relief for us. Our lorries were drawing gravel for to make forestry roads around the country. And they were drawing it from a sandpit down in Ballindoon, Larry Henry's. So we had three lorries on the road drawing gravel. And my God, when we'd hear one of them lorries coming our way home, we were delighted because we could throw our bicycles up on the back and sit into the cab and get a lift home. So we spent a lot of time, it's extraordinary, we spent a lot of time playing on the railway line. And of course in those days it was all steam trains.
Yes.
And we knew how to put our ear down on the track to listen, to see could we, was there a train coming? And we spent a lot of time there and also up on the bridge, throwing chestnuts down into the chimney of the train, which wasn't easy. But we landed a few anyhow, and you'd hear them backfire and the engine would be, man would be out of his fished out the side of the train at us. And we spent, our other big playground was the back of Stewart's Mill, down there in Tarman Lands, just go down from Tarman there. I went back to it there last year. My God, I'd hardly recognise it. It's totally overgrown.
Yeah.
But particularly in the summertime, the mill race was taking most of the water from the river. So there was only a small amount of water coming down there, but enough like to keep the river flowing. But it exposed a big flat rock or slab there. There was a big paving of natural rock there. And in that paving there were pools. So we spent our time with jam jars after collyogs in the little pools. And our signal to come home was the Angelus bell.
All right.
That was...
Get home.
And like, we could go off at, whatever, 2 o'clock or... No one would come running looking for us to see where were we. We were very happy there. My brother Michael and I, there were only 10 and a half months between us. So we went every place together.
Yeah.
And then later, John and Pat would come with us. So we had plenty to play with. Well, there were 8 in my family. I was the 3rd. 5 boys and 3 girls. The 3 girls and myself are alive now. My 4 brothers are gone to their heavenly reward, hopefully. Yeah. So that's the way life goes. You wonder why you're left. But I've spent my time well, I think. I have written, and my first throw at writing was to write my family history. And it wasn't, I didn't just want to write a straight history. I wanted to say something about people and about my father's generation, what worked at teachers or army or whatever. And I also wanted photographs. I suppose I spent 2 or 3 years at it because it was so hard to get people to engage and to take you seriously and give you the photographs. And I collect information at funerals and weddings, and eventually I put it together anyhow. And then a nun came over. She was a second cousin of mine. And she also had been doing it in America. So she filled in all the American blanks and I filled in all the Irish blanks for her. So between us, we produced an interesting book.
Going back there to Barry, you were talking about having dyslexia back in your early school
years.
So obviously, as you said, there was no diagnosis for that back in those days. So compared to these days, where you would get extra help.
Well, I would say my 3 sons had a touch of it.
Right.
But Ursula was a teacher herself, a domestic science teacher. And she helped him, and we also sent 2 of them on a course to somebody in Dublin. And it was no issue then. They got over it.
Yeah, as they do. But back in your day, there wouldn't have been a diagnosis as such for it, as you said.
No.
And how would have that obviously negatively affected your life back then? Did you feel, obviously, a sense of inferiority to other students?
Oh, I did, in school. But I was very loud. My family tell me I was very loud, and I suppose that was my way of making
up for it, yeah.
my presence felt. Mm-hmm. But there are many advantages of having a dyslexic mind, because we think outside the box. And many good business people are dyslexic because they thought outside the box.
They were forced.
Yeah, and we're also very observant. Mm. And it's strange for me now, in all the different books I wrote, they're all about Boyle and his history. So I observed all that unknown to myself as a kid, and now it's all busting out of me, and I love writing it.
Yeah.
And I'm researching a book at the moment, The Boyle River and Its People. So I'm not in the best of health now. I have a breathing oxygen problem, so I'm looking at getting that looked after, and hopefully I'll get that right. But some days I just am flat.
Yeah.
But
And what would have been, okay, so you've written a number of books over the years about Boyle. I think Great Characters in 2010.
Great Characters was my first.
Right. Then you had the one about your family history, A Life in Stone, in 2014. The Day Dare to Challenge, 2016.
Yeah.
We Are the Survivors, 2018, which I love. I love that book.
Yeah.
And obviously, Good Mercy was your last book.
Great Mercy. Oh, the nuns were so happy about that. You know, it was just, I just felt that the nuns in history sort of were gotten a bad deal, because they were so fantastic in education in Boyle.
Yeah.
And when they came here in 1875, and they did great work for charity and for the poor people, and they did great work in the workhouse. But you see, it takes a while to learn how to write a book, because writing my first one was the family one, and I wasn't sure how I'd put it together. So I asked Tony Conby one day anyhow, and Tony came out to me and he said, well, each family, he says, put them in an envelope and you'll be able to keep them separate, and then you can go to each envelope and you'll write it, you'll get used to it that way. And then my head was always full of stories. I had a great character living beside me, Johnny Keaveney. He was a coal merchant from Marigna. He was always telling stories. He's probably never told you about an incident. He thought it was a parable. And Marigna people had their own dialect. And the way he talked, like down, instead of down in Marigna, I was a blow in Marigna.
Right.
And he goes on under, all painted all his lorries blue. I was a blowing rigging under the blue one, he says. And she wouldn't budge. And I was lying under it there on a wet evening. And Pat Boxon came along and he looked at me and he said, are you sure you ever turned on, Mr. Caveney? Well, no, Barry's saying was, I'm not easy vexed, and I wouldn't get vexed with a young fella. But I told him, be off, I says to him. I was driving a lorry before your father's arse was the size of a dessert spoon. So he had great turns of phrase.
Great phrases, yes.
So I was so, so happy when I got that, when I wrote that book. And it was very popular. I sold 2,000 of them.
That was the Great Characters.
The Great Characters, right. Yeah.
And was there any characters from Boyle that would have made that book? Was there?
Oh, well, sure, they were all.
Most of them.
Ned Kelly.
Town Crier, was it?
Bessie Woods. Yeah, Ned Kelly was the Town Crier.
Right.
Bessie Woods, she was a wonderful character. And she lived up to Green. Leisha Tansey. They were very poor times, and there was no aid, no dole, or no handouts, or no Vincent de Paul.
Nothing.
And those people were known as the bag women. There was another lady, Conroy, And they went out to country twice a week. 1 week did go the French Park Road, and the other week did go the Roscommon Road. And they called to the country houses, and they got a few spuds and had a cabbage, butter maybe, if the butter was being churned. Milk, head of cabbage. And they carried all that home. And they were welcome in houses because they had the news of the town with them.
Right, so there was a trade.
And there were characters like, and they were welcome, as I said, in houses, yeah.
Yeah.
Boyle was full of any garrison town.
Yeah.
Bound to have...
One character that keeps coming up when I have these conversations is Sonny Regan.
Oh yeah, Sonny worked with us for...
Did he?
30 years.
All right. Oh, well then, so...
Yeah, he was wonderful. My father used to go over to Essie Lynn, and when he'd call for the father, the old dipper was the caretaker, and when he'd call for the key, Sonny was Deejit sitting at the fire. Like, he was just a bit backward.
Yeah.
And then my father started to say to him, come on over with me. And he'd go over with him. And eventually he gave him a spade or a shovel, and then he started working with us. And he was a very simple man, but I have such fond memories of him. And above all the workers, he's the one that I cherish. Because probably of his simplicity. But he knew his job, he knew what to do, he knew, put him in front of a wheelbarrow and he'd wheel all day, and he'd mix concrete and he'd dig out foundations. And he'd always say the wrong word in the wrong place. So there was always entertainment with him. And then at football matches, he was always in rows. And he'd be in this row, and fellas would be sort of frightened. He'd be standing out, and he'd throw off the coat, and come on. So I'd run down, and I said, stop, Sonny, what's wrong? And it was always the same thing. He called me a fucking bollocks. It was always the same. So he'd manufacture something himself.
A great character. Yeah. You were talking earlier a bit about the train station. And I remember a few years ago seeing a YouTube video with yourself and the late Frank Tarpey talking about how important the train station was to a town back in the early days.
Oh, it sure was vital.
Yeah.
All the goods came. I mean, Candon's had 3 carts drawing goods from the railway station down to their stores in Patrick Street. They were a very big company.
Yeah.
And then they distributed that all around Keju, Ballyfern, and all around that area. And then you had another fella, Cox. Candon was drawn for himself, and he had 3 horses and carts going full-time all day. And then Cox had 1 cart, and he was drawn, and he mainly went to the shops. He did the shops, but everything came by train.
Yeah.
And of course, to go to Dublin or wherever you wanted to go, to Sligo, the train was wonderful, yeah.
And can you remember the snow of 47?
Very little.
Because I'm sure that would have disrupted everything back
then. As far as I know, I just have a memory of Sonny Gannon, delivering the milk. And he had a sleigh. And he had a horse and sleigh, and he was going around with the horse and sleigh delivering the milk.
Right.
But I have very little, I was only 7 then, so I have very little memory of it.
Yeah. So going back to what I mentioned at the start, your involvement with the Boyle Arts Festival. As far as I remember, it was 1983 was the very first one, was it, or 84?
Well, we'll say... In my earlier years, the GAA was my full focus. And I gave 25 years of my younger life and into adulthood, up to I was 35 maybe, to the GAA. I was chairman, and we decided to buy the Abbey Park in my time, and that was a huge, huge move. And it was funny the way it worked out. PJ Kane, John McGowan, and another man, I just can't think who it was, and myself were at a funeral of a fella called Bertie Miller up in Great Meadow. And we were coming home anyhow, and we started chatting, and we decided that we'd buy Abbey Park. So we made that known anyhow. By God, what happened on Kenan Dodd? He was president of St. Mary's School at the time. And didn't he go and buy it? And Jesus, we were mad. But a stone transpired that it was an inspired stroke of his, because there was a field up at his school, which is now the football field up at the college, at Abbey College. And it was owned by the Tarman Trust. And I was a member of the Tarman Trust at the time. And for some reason or another, we wouldn't sell it to him. But when he bought the pitch, he swapped it for this field that he wanted. So now the Town's Trust owned the Abbey Park, and I was a member of the Trust. Micheál O'Callaghan was chairman of the Trust. He was editor of the Scommon Herald. And Paddy Daly, who was a wholesale and pub and auctioneer in the town there, he was the secretary. So it was easy dealing with them, and we bought the pitch off them for 6,000 at the time. They gave us 2,000 back to develop it, and they gave another 2,000 to various clubs in the town. So it was money well spent. Mm. But that was a big move, and then I went on and I was chairman of the Northern Board for 4 years. But my business was growing, and I needed to give it my full attention, so I sort of withdrew from the GAA. But then the Arts Festival, I remember it was a Mrs. Foley, and she was involved, and the first Arts Festival was run by David Knight, and there was another guy from Carrick, I just can't think of his name, and Mrs. Foley was involved. She wasn't a native of Boyle now, but she was very interested in Boyle and did a lot of work when she was here.
And David Knight, is that the photographer?
Yeah, right. David, okay. Yeah. So they ran the first festival, and it was more or less to exhibit their work. So they were having a general meeting anyhow, the second general meeting, down in the Royal Hotel, and there was no one at it only themselves. And Bernadette rang me, and she says, would you ever come down? She says, because there'll be no arts festival if we don't get it organised. So I went down, and I was made treasurer. And that was my start in the festival. So we did run one. Sean O'Dowd was big in at that time with me. And there was a girl, she worked with us, Regina Candon. She was secretary. So we went along those lines for a number of years. And then I invited Fergus Ahern to join us. And of course, once Fergus came in, it was soon Fergus's festival, because he was a powerhouse.
Right.
He had a wonderful appreciation of art and was a good judge and knew who to invite. And we had probably one of the best art exhibitions in Ireland. Bernadette Foley was chairperson for a while, and then I was chairperson for. So I gave 25 years of my time to the Boyle Arts Festival.
Yeah.
And when Fergus died, I took over selecting the art. But I hadn't the flair that he had, and I knew that. So I did it for 3 years, and then I decided not to do it anymore. There's a huge amount of work.
I was going to ask that. Is there a lot involved in organising?
Well, in the committee, and my daughter was involved in the committee, and she did a lot of the organising of the events. But selecting the pictures, and then when over 100, maybe 140 pictures came down, and to hang all them And it wasn't just a matter of sticking them up on the wall. You had to hang them in some order that they looked well.
Yes, yeah.
So that was a huge job.
Yeah, can imagine.
Yeah, so, but I gave, as I said, 25 years to it, and it has powered on.
It has, and I think it has got the reputation of being one of the better art festivals in the country, still to this day.
Yeah, it's big in the performing arts now. But it's gone better and better, and so has the GAA Club gone better and better. It was never as good as it is now.
Oh, not at all.
And the Arts Festival is great for the town, it's great for business. So it has many, many advantages. And a lot of young people in Boyle have followed the arts as a result of the Boyle Arts Festival.
Right. And you mentioned you'd done some volunteer work over the years as well.
Well, they were my two big voluntary work.
And apart from them, was there any other organisations?
I was president of the Chamber of Commerce and I was in the Chamber of Commerce, which was very active at that time, for a number of years, trying to develop different things in Boyle. And then I was also elected to the Boyle Towns Commissioners.
Okay.
And I was in that for maybe 3, 4, 5 years, I don't know, whatever the term was. But again, our business was growing and growing, and we bought a quarry in Kilkenny, and we had 55 men working down there, and we had 50 men or 55 maybe working in Boyle.
Yeah.
So my business needed my full attention. And I couldn't have done any of that work without my brother Pat. But poor Pat died of cancer when he was only 47.
Very young.
So he was the managing director of the company at that time. So then I took over, and I enjoyed those years. I enjoyed the quarry so much. It was just wonderful, your battle with nature. Because every stone, whether it was good or bad, it had to come out of the way. And it was always a challenge, whether you'd have cracks or fissures, or there was flint in the quarry. But we knew the quarry, we knew where the flint was. We sort of knew the good, the limestone is a sedimentary stone, so it's formed in beds. And each bed represents millions of years. And then for some reason or another, the weather changed. And there's a break. And you can see that in the quarry, the little, what we call stylites. But that was the bed. And then if the weather changed, it showed it. You know, when you had real bad weather, you had very dark stone. And then where you had good seasons, you had a much lighter bluey stone. And down at the bottom of the quarry, you had a fossil bed. And that was formed when Ireland was a tropical sea. And all the debris, the sea debris and the sand fell down to the bottom of the water. And eventually formed into a solid mass. And that's a beautiful stone with all the sea pampagrass and all the different vegetation and fish you can see in it. A lot of that we sent to Amsterdam. They had a big project in Amsterdam some years ago now, and maybe the 90s and on into the 20s, where they had to restore all the banks of the canal and the bridges. So we got to, well, you know, a company in Ghent in Belgium got the contract of restoring them, and they bought all the limestone from us. So when you're walking through Amsterdam, you're very likely walking on Kilkenny limestone.
Right, interesting fact, yeah. Not many people would have known that.
Oh, yeah, it was wonderful, the stone, the limestone. But, like, see, there were different periods when I go back to my young days as a stonecutter. I took great interest in styles of headstones, and I took great interest in carving, interlacing. And I remember often visiting Glasnevin Cemetery and see some of the old masters there and the different interlacing that they used. So I used to take a rubbing of them, and I was able to reproduce it myself. But it took great concentration when you were carving, interlacing, or carving the passion flower or the roses. And that was all by hand. Now, you did have a pneumatic hammer, but that didn't take any of the skill out of it. That was just replacing the striking hammer.
Okay.
And
things have changed in that way.
Well, you see, in those days, to be a monumental sculptor, we say, you had to have a skill. So you had to be able to make them.
Yeah.
But now, it's just, headstones are just a commodity.
Right, okay.
And they're imported from China and India.
Yeah, okay.
So you don't have to be a stonecutter anymore. It's just a commodity now.
So Feely Stone was founded in 1780 by Christy Feely. So that
it was a Patrick was. Patrick came down in every generation early.
All right.
I'm the ninth generation.
Ninth. So this year will be 243 years.
Well, possibly, yeah. But in those early days, you see, it wasn't a business. They were just journeymen. They were,
right.
We'll say they worked at the cathedral, in building the cathedral in Ballyhadreen.
Right.
So they went over on the Ginnett and Cart on maybe a Sunday night, and to stay there and come back Friday evening. And then a lot of the stone that was being used was on private houses. And so Rockingham, of course, they had a quarry in Rockingham, and they built some of the bridges in Rockingham. So it was really came into a stable business in my grandfather's time.
Right.
And at that time, we lived in Upper Great Meadow. And we lived under the same roof as a family, McPherson's. And we were evicted from the Kirkwood's place in Woodbrook, which is halfway between here and Carrick. The golf club there is Woodbrook. Well, that was... the Woodbrook house is still there. There's a... And Mayor Reynolds lives in it now. And we were evicted from there, and we were given a place up in Great Meadow with 6 acres. And as I said, those two houses were under the same roof. It was a galvanised roof. And they had their monumental yard there. But in those days, like, they might have made maybe 20 headstones in a whole year. And then, you see, in my days, when I started by hand at the stone cutting, it was all limestone. And we used to get the limestone from a small quarry over in Partry in Mayo. And it was a small quarry because it had beds of stone. It was a lake, we'd call it a lake, it was near a lake. So it was formed under a lake rather than the sea. And it was a lovely consistent stone for lettering, because in those days when you were cutting a letter and you were cutting a B, and remember a B, there's two little islands, and you could pop them out very easy. So the Partly Stone was a beautiful stone to work. And there were a family there by the name of Coins. And my father was sent over a list. And they'd quarried the stone. As I said, there were only about 2-foot-high beds. And they'd quarried the stone and they'd rough punch it into some, to make it, they'd break it down with a sledge into more or less the size that you wanted.
Yeah.
So then when that stone came to us, it had to be worked on 6 sides. And in those days, when I started, it had taken me a week to make a base, to punch it, put a draft on it, get the caliper and smooth it down, because the punching only brought it down so far. Then you use a caliper, which had like a comb, and with the hand, with the mallet and chisel, you combed it sort of with that, and that brought it down more. Mm. And then they had a system before we got the sander. They had a system where they used to get a sandstone from the curlews, and they had it on 2 poles. So there were 3 fellas involved. One fella on each pole, shifting it over and back, and another fella throwing sand in under it and water. And that's the way they give the stone a refinement so that they could letter it.
Right.
So it was very slow.
How long did it typically take to make a piece?
Oh, well, like, I mean, they made wonderful monuments of Celtic Cross. Oh, I'd say at least a month.
Right.
Oh, at least.
So how would that have changed then toward, obviously, well, then, doing it by hand is gone.
Then the pottery thing, it was hard to get the stone, and sometimes the quarries would be flooded. And then we went to Carlow, and there they had a proper quarry, Walsh's of Carlow. And we bought the stone there, and they saw the stone there in frame saws with water and shot and a saw going over and back, steel blade. It had no teeth, but it was just the grit, the sand and that. So that was very slow, and
yeah,
it wasn't that 100% accurate, but a few mil didn't matter one way or the other in the monumental business.
Yeah.
So we got the stone, it was come to the railway station in Boyle, and then eventually we went down with our lorry to that place, and we bought stone there, and eventually then we were buying the bases, and they were sawn and all, they were sawn and secondary saw, so they were smooth all over. And in 1975 a Welsh quarry came on the market there. The son was, they were big farmers also, and he was more interested in the farm. He didn't want to be involved in the quarry. So after a bit of chat and a help from another brother, James Walsh, he was a great friend of mine there, we bought the quarry. I think it was something short of 100,000. Well, that was huge money to us.
That would have been back
in 1975.
Yeah,
we had never borrowed money. But we had a house in Dublin that I had bought earlier, and Pat and I owned, and we had that restored up and down. Ursula was a big help to me at that time. And we put that on the market, but we didn't sell it for a year after. And it was a man from Boyle bought it, John Kelly, the Landis Kelly people, we'll say.
Okay.
So that was, we got 50,000 for that. And then we borrowed the rest. But the big mistake we made, and we didn't understand really very much of banking and that, the bank insisted that we put up our houses as
collateral.
Mm. And for a full year afterwards, I was very bad with my nerves over, because the tape would come on in my mind and I couldn't stop it. I could be at a football match and something would say something and the tape would come on. Right. And it was always disaster. Your house was gone. You're on the side of the road. But we worked hard at it, and my brother Pat took charge of the quarry, and we made a great success of it, and we built it into a...
And you still have that quarry today?
No.
No.
In that downturn, I retired in 1960, and we had a manager for a while who was very good. He was a quarry manager, and he was a wonderful quarry manager. But things didn't go that well for him, and I suppose it wasn't easy to come in to manage a family business. But eventually my nephew, Patrick, came home from America, and he was the knight on the white horse. He had qualified from Berkeley University in business studies and all that. So he had a total different approach to business than our traditional style. So he took over the quarry he became managing director, and but he liked to travel, and he put a manager into the quarry who didn't know very much about the stone business, and he went to Belgium himself and worked with another stone company. And then we had that downturn, and we had a winter of frost, and the quarry was closed for a fortnight, and been one thing and another, anyhow. The bank took it over, which was a terrible blow to me, because my brother Pat and I literally did sweat blood over that.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful move for us at the time, because it's brought us into the national scene and brought us into the export of stone to Belgium, Germany, and we had a customer in Holland, I think. So it was very, very exciting going to visit those people and getting the stone they wanted. And, I loved this.
Yeah.
And going to Carrara. And I was always looking to see how did they do things, and bringing home the different new machinery and buying them. And it was a wonderful challenge. I loved it. And at that time, I was managing director, we'll say, and I was living in Boyle. But we bought an apartment in Kilkenny, and we went to Kilkenny usually on a Wednesday, and we came home Thursday night. And my good wife, Ursula, was my brick then, because she did all the driving. Because sometimes I'd come out from a meeting down there and I wouldn't be fit to drive.
I'd be brain dead, I'd say.
And she did all the driving, and she was great talking to our customers, and she was an absolute brick to me. And I never had to worry about how our family were doing, because she managed all that.
Well, I was just going to say, it takes something special for a family to continually run a business through 10 generations, because you have to constantly innovate, invest as you did during times when there's economic downturns. So there has to have been something special in the whole operation.
Well, it's interesting. Three of my sons are in the stone business. Colin has his own business. He lives in Kilkenny, and he is a stone contractor, and he fixes stone to buildings. So when a building needs to be clad with stone, it goes out for a contract, he quotes for it, he gets it. Then he has draftsmen, and every stone has to be drawn to where it's going to fit exactly. So he uses a lot of stone from Portugal, granite, and he uses some limestone, of course, and different stones. And he has that. He has a very good business himself there. And then Finbar is the manager of Boyle, and his brother Shane works with him. And the interesting thing is that Finbar and Shane work together. My father and his brother Christy work together. My grandfather and his brother John work together.
Yourself and Pat.
And myself and Pat.
So maybe that's the secret ingredient that it can last all the generations, is that brothers working.
Possibly. Brothers, there's great strength in brothers working.
Isn't that what isn't there a monument on, isn't the one in Shillen?
Yeah, well that's...
That is a...
When Pat died, I asked Alan Coonahan, he was a sculptor from Kilkenny, said I wanted to create a public monument that would represent brothers. And he came up with that. So you might call them chestnuts or oranges or whatever. And the smooth one is Pat. His cycle is complete. And his seed is left to grow in his family. And the rough one with just one segment out of it is me, maturing.
Right. Yes.
So, still maturing.
Yeah, it's a nice monument.
It's lovely.
It is. And
it's playful for kids too. They love sitting into
it. Quite, yeah, and it has the meaning behind it of the brothers, power and brothers working together, which I think is a good... What, in your time, Barry, how would you think Boyle has changed for the better over your lifetime?
Well, Boyle has gone down. There's no question of that. I mean, we had three hotels in Boyle one time and now we have none.
Yeah.
Possibly there were a number of big businesses, but they didn't invest, or I don't know. I just can't explain why the town went down, but it did. And Carrick has improved, you know, immensely. But Carrick was a border town. And there were a lot of grants for developing different things in Carrick. And that was, I would say, a huge help to Carrick to develop. But I believe Boyle will come back stronger than ever. Because the tourist attractions and the history and the monuments we have around Boyle are just...
Second to none.
But they're neglected. I mean, as a young fella, I had very little connection to the Abbey. And all my life, how much of a connection have I to the Abbey? How much of a connection has Boyle to the Abbey? 12th century, it's a wonderful building. We should have a lot more connection and events and be involved in it.
Yeah, I agree.
Then you look at Lough Gara. I mean, Lough Gara and its crannogs.
Huge history there.
There were 250 crannogs.
And they drained
the whole
it.
Town.
Yeah.
And then when they drained it, they were all exposed. But there were just heaps of stone now. But I believe that there should have been an interpretive centre built there and one of the... crannogs
restored.
I mean, the crannogs are older than Newgrange.
Yeah,
they're older than the pyramids. You know, but they're just
left there.
They're just left there, but they need to be developed.
Yeah,
and so I mean, when I was in Australia, Jesus, the things that bring you to see, there were only pimples in comparison to what we have. And the great dolmen we have in Tinnicara there.
That's exactly.
One of the biggest in Ireland.
That's older than the pyramids as well.
Yeah. We have great, great monuments.
It's just not being showcased.
It's not being showcased, yeah.
Which is a shame.
Mm.
A shame.
But I do believe that people, well, the... COVID and, you know, that whole scene where we were closed down for 2 years, people did start to look around at local and people did become more appreciative of living outside the city And now that roads are so wonderful roads, you know, you can go to Dublin in 2 hours. One time it took you 4 hours. And the railway will be developed more. And it's easier to get around, and you'll see more people, and then people can work from home with their computers.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a business there. That's and you right. can live any place in the world.
Yep.
And continue with your business. So you're certainly going to see more mobility. But the big fear I have, we have a wonderful country. We have a wonderful lifestyle. When people in Africa and India and a lot of those Middle Eastern countries find out our lifestyle, will be swamped. You know, we're talking about how many refugees we have now.
It's only going to increase.
It's only going to increase, and you can put up all the barriers you like. You won't stop the human being.
No.
If that's the way they want to go. So I do fear that
we're losing our culture if that happens.
Yes, that's...
gets diluted.
Yes, well, that's the important thing, is to educate them. And Tuesday, I had the great joy of going into the Carrie's class, which is fourth class in the girls' national school. And I did a talk on the workhouse in Boyle and famine, because the teacher, Miss Keenan, who's a wonderful teacher there for them, was bringing them through. They were doing their history, and that was what they were doing. So I had the great joy of going through my book that I did on the famine, which was probably my best book. And in that class, there were at least half a dozen coloured people.
Yeah.
And they were just like any of the other kids, interested.
Yeah. Keep them interested in the local history.
And there were maybe 20 in the class there, and they were glued to every word. It was wonderful to do that for them.
Especially someone like yourself coming in,
yeah,
that has having written a book on the subject that they're learning about in school, would have been a great bonus for them. Growing up in Boyle, any favourite memories that still stick out in your mind fondly? There are probably many, but is there any kind of standout memories that you look back on fondly?
Well, in those years, Cowboys and Indians, we went to the cinema every Sunday evening for the matinee. Fourpence to get in. We were in the back seats. And the Cowboys and Indians, 'twas always that Hopalong Cassidy, the James Brothers. Oh, 'twas... And then we used to recreate those scenes ourselves. And we had a field at the back of the yard there, up the hill. And we had a frying pan. We called it the Frying Pan Gang. And of course, we whipped sausages out of the house and out of some of the businesses in town, and lit a fire and put on our pan, and we were Indians.
Yeah.
Michael Devine, he spent most of his life in England. He's living out in Felton now.
Oh, that's right, that Michael Devine.
Michael, yeah.
I know him, yeah.
He was one of our chiefs. And it was another lad, Viv Lavin, he became a High Court judge after he died there a few years ago. There were John Kelly of Londis, he was involved a bit. And they were happy days.
Innocent days.
Yeah.
Things
And my time down at the back of Stewart's Mill, fishing with the jam jar in the pools of water. And we'd bring them home, and one time we decided to have a museum, and we had different bats and different fish in them. But of course, when they started to smell, my father came in one evening and emptied them all. And then we used to have circuses. and we used to do plays. Down at the back in the field, we used to have a circus, penny to get in. And of course, there were clowns. There was a slack wire. We had a bit of ropes on a tree, and we were doing some tricks there. And then my brother Joe was older than, he was the eldest of the family, but he was the professor, and he was always interested in radio and mechanical stuff. Yeah. But he set up a bicycle out in the cowhouse, and over the cowhouse there was a loft for the hay. So in the summertime the loft would be, it'd be empty. And I don't know, he was showing a film and he had a camera, and to power it, either my brother Michael or I were down on the bicycle, and there was a dynamo on it. And we were powering the film. And of course we'd get tired, and he'd shout down, keep cycling.
Jeez, how times have changed.
Yeah, so, and he was a good musician. And he used to play the accordion, and he used to complain sometimes then. He says, I'm the Egypt up here playing the accordion, and you're down there dancing with all the women.
So before I wrap it up, Barry, is there anything that I haven't touched on that you'd like to talk about?
Let's just take this. Pope John the 23rd gave us a great break in business. After the Second Vatican Council, which was around 1965, I think, he instructed the priests of the world to say Mass facing the people. Prior to that, they faced the tabernacle and the reredos, which was a big ornamental structure at the back of the altar against the wall. So we then were employed all over Ireland, actually, to take out those altars from under the reredos, move them out so that the priest could be in behind them and face the people. Now, I knew nothing about it, but being a stonecutter, I said I'd take a chance at it. And the first one we did was in Croaghan. And I was very nervous about it and didn't sleep that night. And every bit of it we took down, I marked it. And it took us a day to take it down. And then we put it up in 2 days. And there was just one piece I noticed that was upside down, but nobody else would notice it. But once I had one done, I discovered then they were all much the same format. And really, the first altar I took down, I was really disappointed, because all my life I was looking up in Boyle at that wonderful, big, strong lump of an altar. But when I took it down, I discovered it was just made up of pieces, a whole lot of pieces put together, and the centre of it was just concrete blocks. So it was really the jam for us, because the monumental business was good, and we were doing it over a big area. And it's interesting to note that now in that area that we worked in, there are seven monumental guys working, all who served their time with us, all making a good living for themselves, and good luck to them. So we're still at the monumental, not in as big an area as we were. But in the monumental, is very competitive, and there's a price that can't be exceeded. But the altar work was different. It wasn't a matter of price. It was being know how to do it, and to go in on early on a Monday morning and be finished on Friday evening, so that when the people came back into church on the Sunday, it was a fait accompli. The job was done. So we worked hard, and we worked through the night in some places. So we got a good price for our work, and that gave us the encouragement to continue to invest in our business. And that really was the big big break that we were able to build up our business. Now, when I talked earlier about serving my time with my father, and his two brothers were also working in the business. But I also had to pick up some of the skills of the blacksmith, because I had to be able to sharpen my own tools. And my Uncle James, who was a sergeant in the Guards in Rush, had come home to Boyle to retire, and he wanted to go back to his roots because he was a stonecutter before he joined the Guards. And he wanted to go back to his roots, so he came working in the yard. But he was very fond of going into the forge, because the forge was a bit of a dodge. It was nice and warm, because outside in the east wind was blowing. It was bloody cold, I can tell you. But I very frequently went with him to the forge. I'd light the fire, get it going, and I'd blow the bellows while he was heating the tools, sharpening them with the hammer on the anvil, letting them cool, and then the tricky part was tempering them. And he'd take them up, and we had an old broken skillet pot, and there was a certain amount of water in that, and he'd put it in, he'd heat the tip, just the tip of the tool, dip it in the water, and then you'd see tungsten running. And when it was blue, and then just at the top to turn grey, and just about 5 millimetres from the top, you dip it again, and that stopped the grey from going any further. And that was the real hard part of the steel. And then after that, you rubbed it on an old sandstone we got from the Curlews, and then you had to nurse it, as we'd call it, not hit it too hard until you seasoned it. So that was all part of the stone cutting trade, to be able to sharpen your own tools. Oh, for a period, we erected quite a number of memorials in the north of Ireland. And we had some dealings with the IRA, but never directly with the IRA. One day, an architect from Mullingar came into the yard, and he wanted the base. He wanted a granite base, 3 big blocks of stone made for a bronze piece that they were putting on a general monument in Andersonstown Cemetery, wasn't it, I think? Yeah. And, Andersonstown. And so we made the deal with Romania. It was 10,000 at the time. Gave us a deposit of 3. Gave us 3 more when it was ready for erection, and a balance when it was erected. So I remember myself and my son Finbar went up with the lorry, and we had to hire a crane, and we couldn't bring the crane into the cemetery. But fortunately, the graves where we were erecting these 3 blocks was near the boundary, and there was a scrapyard there. What the hell was his name? He was the manager of the boxer that won the world championship. Can't think of his name now, but he gave us permission to go in there with the crane, and we could lift the blocks off the lorry and place them where we wanted to place them. And then at lunchtime, we hadn't it finished, and they brought us down to the Andersonstown Social Centre. And it was buzzing. The bar was just buzzing. And we were brought into this back room anyhow, and all the big pictures of the hunger strikers were on the walls. And there were about 3 of them, and there was 3 or 4 of us. And I remember the woman that was serving us came in, and she had, we're having soup, and she had little slices of bread cut up. Now she said, they're British soldiers, she says, dip them well in the soup. But when we were going into the cemetery, my son Finbar said to me, he said, is it kings that are buried here? All the big monuments, because there's fantastic monuments there. No, I says, they're all the IRA. Oh, he said, I thought they were the baddies. Oh, I says, shush, 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 shush. There's nothing about that here. So we got the job done anyhow. And there was a gap maybe of 4 inches between two of the stones. And I said, that looks natural. No, we'll leave it there like that. We will not, he says. And I had brought granite dust with me. And we made up a mixture anyhow with cement and granite dust. And we filled them. Oh, he says, that's better. He says, I don't want some prod, he says, coming up here with a sticky gel ignite and putting it in there and blowing the piece to bits. So then we were, now we had to finish. Now he says, you wait there, he says, and your money will be delivered to you. So we were waiting around anyhow. It was a console I had at the time. And next thing, this black taxi comes flittering into the cemetery. And your man lets down the window and he hands out a brown paper bag. He says, it's all there, you don't need to count it. By Jesus, we were glad. And the two fellas had sunglasses on them. And I was afraid we wouldn't get outside the cemetery, will be taken off me again. But no, and the Royals were very honourable in those matters. And we went down to the Andersonstown Bank of Ireland and lodged it. By God, I was a happy man.
It was in the bank safe and done.
I was safe then.
Well, Barry, that's great. Listen, it's been a pleasure chatting to you, and thank you very much for inviting me into your home to record the episode.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, I hope I haven't done justice to my time, because it's hard to recall it. It's hard to recall 60 year or more in a short time. But I'm glad you're doing this, Carlo. I think it's great service to the town, and it's only in time to come that it will be appreciated.
Thanks very much.
Because I find that with all the books I wrote them with that in mind,
yeah,
particularly for my children, that when I'm not around to answer their questions, they can look it up.
Exactly, and that's the same kind of concept we're doing with this. So,
good man.
Thank you very much, Barry.
God bless you.
Bye bye.